I'm Scott.
I'm Bill.
And we're the Trade Guys.
You're listening to The Trade Guys, a podcast produced by CSIS where we talk about trade in terms that everyone can understand. I'm H. Andrew Schwartz, and I'm here with Scott Miller and Bill Reinsch, the CSIS Trade Guys. And Trey, guys, we're back, we're rested, we consumed lots of turkey, and later in this episode, we're going to talk about whiskey. I'm excited.
Excellent.
Is this like Nixon, Andrew, tanned, rested, and ready? Is that what you're saying?
I don't know about tanned. I was in Cleveland, Bill, and there's no sun this time of year in Cleveland.
That's right. You have to find a tanning booth to get tanned in Northeast Ohio at this time of year.
That's right. Like, there's like a sliver of sun peeking through the clouds occasionally. That's about it.
Why were you in Cleveland?
My wife's family's from Cleveland, and we always spend Thanksgiving in Cleveland, including a huge family touch football game. Really cool. And everybody's doing well. So who is
great Midwestern traditions.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
No injuries, I hope.
No injuries. And I definitely avoided injury by not playing.
That's one route.
It's real wisdom at your age, Andrew.
I'm coaching at this point.
To know when to say when.
That's right. Several of my big kids sat out too for fear of injury because, you know, they need to save themselves for the real thing.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about trade day at COP28. It's exciting. And who knew that there was a big trade component? What's it all about, guys?
Well, it's already started. I think it's a big deal. It's an annual big deal, and it becomes more important with each passing year as we fail to meet our obligations to try to retard planet warming. A new feature this year is what you mentioned, Trade Day. The biggest thing you can say about Trade Day, which is December 4th, is lots and lots and lots of talk. 47 sessions, 200 speakers. So a lot of words about trade and climate. And that's probably about all you're going to get out of Trade Day is a lot of talk. That's not to say, however, that there's not something coming out of COP in general. And in fact, even today, the opening day, they've already had an accomplishment, which was sort of prearranged, but which is important. And that is they reached agreement on to launch their what may end up being their major deliverable, we'll see, which is to institutionalize the Loss and Damage Fund, or the Climate Disaster Relief Fund, which is a fund basically rich countries contributing to help poor countries deal with the damage caused by climate disasters of various sorts. And there's some interesting data about disasters in the process. Rich countries' disasters tend to be storms, hurricanes, things like that. Poor countries' disasters tend to be drought, fires, and also floods. The two countries that are hardest hit by floods this past year have been Malawi and Cambodia. And Malawi is landlocked. Not everybody is on the coast. You can still have flood problems with, you know, rivers, other things. So getting countries to agree on this is important. Not only getting them to agree, but some countries have already kicked in money. Or they said they'll kick in money, let me put it that way. The U.S. has put it in $17.5 million. This is all U.S. dollars. $17.5 million. Japan, $10 million. The UAE, which is the host and usually is expected to step up big time, $100 million. The U.K., $51 million. The EU, as collectively, is the biggest contributor, $245.39 million U.S. dollars. 100 million of that alone is from Germany. So the EU is doubling down on COP28, which I think is a good thing. There is always the question of promises versus delivery, which we've seen over and over again in the trade sector. There's an interesting report, admittedly, from an activist group, which suggests you may want to relook at the numbers. But what they reported at a COP press conference was point out that two-thirds of the finance commitments that countries made between 2013 and 2021 were never delivered. And that amounts to $343 billion. So a lot gets promised, but a lot less gets actually paid. Nevertheless, getting this done the first day is a good start. And it's also tactically a good start because it means that unlike in previous COPs, the fund is not going to be a bargaining chip where previous countries would withhold their approval of it because they wanted to get something else in some other part of the negotiation. Now this is done and therefore is reasonably off the table, except for getting more countries to subscribe to it. So that's all good news. The other thing, the two other things that are going to happen, there's a lot of things that are going to happen, but two other important things that are going to happen is there's going to be the usual annual global stock taking where countries report on how well they're doing meeting their commitments under the Paris Agreement, which was a commitment to limit global warming to less than 2 degrees centigrade, or for Americans in the audience, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. So countries will report how well they're doing. Presumably, they'll all have something positive to say, and then the question will be whether you believe them or not. And then finally, I think this is probably not going to come to a head, but we will have another chapter in the ongoing debate about what to do about fossil fuels. And I think partly the debate now is focusing in on, are we going to commit to phase it out, or are we going to commit to phase them down? And there's a big difference. If you're an oil company, of course, you're interested in phasing down, and you want a date as far in the future as you can negotiate. If you're a climate-affected country, you probably want, or an environmental activist, you want to phase out, and you want to phase out as quickly as possible. That will be a contentious debate and probably not one where they produce a definitive solution. But it'll be interesting to watch the debate. I think there's a lot of pressure on oil companies this time to step up, and not only to step up with commitments, but to step up with payments, including into some of this fund and various other things they can do to help poor countries deal with the consequences of fossil fuel use. So that's the report from COP28. And since it goes on for basically another 10 days or so, we'll probably have another report at a later podcast.
So let me ask a silly question, guys. How can trade contribute to the renewable transition?
Well, look, I think it's great that trade negotiators are getting involved in this. And here's the basic outlines of how they can contribute. First, as background, those of you who are readers of the Wall Street Journal, we're recording on November 30th today. And today's issue of the Wall Street Journal, Greg Yip, the economics columnist, has an excellent piece on why the energy transition is so difficult. And he points out that many technological changes when there's a tech transition are what's called positive supply shocks. So whether it's from whale oil to kerosene, or from coal-powered ships to oil-powered ships, or from horse and buggy to railroads, then to automobiles, in each case, there was a supply shock, but it was positive, and it made the investment, because it was more efficient to go to what was new, the investments paid out. And in the case of the net zero or whatever the climate goal is, these are negative supply shocks. We're moving from a more efficient to less efficient operation. So it takes subsidies up front, and it takes a decision about who pays for it as you go along. So, you know, you could see it show up now. It showed up first in investment as interest rates went from near the zero bound to about 5%, which is sort of normal rates of monetary policy, policy rate. And so look at offshore wind, for instance. So about 30% of the U.S. offshore wind has been canceled since interest rates went up. Another 25% is being repriced. Okay, EVs. This week, electrical vehicles, there was a letter from 3,000 auto dealers in the United States to President Biden. And they said, hey, let's tap the brakes on this EV conversion. And the reason is they've got 53 days inventory on average at their dealerships of internal combustion engine cars, and they've got 107 days inventory on electric vehicles. So there's a problem that the dogs don't seem to like the dog food. But in any case, these fissures are a function of what Greg Ipp called the negative supply shock. Yeah, it gets expensive. The politics are getting tough too. Germany has been a leader in this area. They have a green coalition in the majority now, but they got a very painful ruling from the Constitutional Court last week. And Chancellor Scholz to no longer use health-related subsidies to help Germans through their much higher energy costs. So the Constitutional Court basically said, hey, when the Constitution says balanced budget, it means balanced budget. So energy is going to get extraordinarily expensive in Germany. We'll see how they deal with it, as they seem committed. But the politics, when the economics are tough, the politics get tough. Here's where trade negotiators factor in. They're pragmatic people. They tackle problems practically. Trade negotiator would be well aware that if there's going to be a green transition, somebody's got to pay for it. And what that means is no off-the-books subsidies. So I thought about the movie Goodfellas, and there's a scene about sort of dealing with the outfit if you're in business with them. And since this is a family show, instead of using the phrase they did use, Ray Liotta used, I'll say, well, too bad, pay me. Okay, you remember what too bad was.
Sure.
But so you think about, oh, look, there's a rule about industrial subsidies. The industrial subsidies rule, the WTO, is that all industrial trade sorting subsidies are bad. And they ought to be disciplined. Well, the Greens come in and say, hey, we have some good trade distorting subsidies. And the trade negotiator says, too bad, pay me. You know, they're going to bargain for it. Okay, same thing, production process methods. The WTO has long said production process methods don't matter. A widget's a widget's a widget. Doesn't matter how you make it. So the Greens come in and say, well, what about green steel? And the trade negotiator said, too bad, pay me. Right? And what that does is brings tangible progress to these areas where people are actually willing to step up and fund it, make concessions in other areas of their trade agenda. So I'm frankly thrilled to see this. And we can't subsidize away all the way there. I think the voters will catch on and punish who's ever close to the decision. But having said that, I think trade negotiators will add a positive element to what's a very difficult process.
Well, I'm frankly thrilled with a Goodfellas reference. And I think going forward, every episode of The Trade Guys should have at least one Goodfellas and or Godfather reference.
It's actually possible. Those two movies are so fabulous for the quotable quotes and the expressions. We could do that.
That's kind of interesting. And the wisdom can be applied to just about everything in modern life.
Yep. Too bad. Pay me.
Sounds a little bit like my son, my younger son, who told me at one point he didn't need to go to school anymore because everything he needs to know in life he can learn from The Simpsons.
He learned from The Simpsons.
Yeah, not the Godfather, but The Simpsons. So there are other sources of wisdom in media.
Yeah, South Park being one, but we'll debate that later.
These kids.
If I can add something on the subsidies front, that was unrelated to COP. There was an interesting development that does relate to something we've talked about before. There are now stories that the administration may ease up on its EV, some of its EV requirements for getting the EV credits, at the urging, incidentally, of Senator Stabenow, a senator from Michigan, who has finally come to realize that some of these requirements, such as no Chinese minerals, kick in before there's been time enough to adjust supply chains to accommodate them. So what is actually going to happen in 2024, and Tesla has already notified its customers about this, is the transition to EVs is actually going to slow down because the old credits are going to go away. The new credits are going to come in. The new credits can't be met yet because they have these restrictions on what minerals can be used and where they can be processed. And nobody under the statute, you can't get rid of the requirements. But there is now some sign that the administration may lengthen the period before they kick in to give companies more time to comply. That will, I think, prevent the transition from decelerating and may do something about the 107-day inventory that Scott's talking about. We'll see.
Guys, we got another one of our favorite topics to talk about, and that is none other than USMCA.
Yes.
Yes. The U.S. seems to have lost its second USMCA panel dispute on dairy. What happened?
Well, let's see. How do I maintain politeness in this circumstance? First of all, the good news is that many, many U.S. agriculture countercyclical and subsidy programs used to be just like the dairy program. And the vast majority of them have been reformed that allow farmers to plant for the market. and the government gets involved when there's an urgent need. The dairy program, unfortunately, in both the United States and Canada, are still the old school. Essentially, the government creates a cartel and operates it for the benefit of the existing producers. They do that in lots of ways, but this is what a former Texas congressman and one-time House Majority Leader, Richard Darmy, who was an economics professor as well before he came to Congress, wrote a book about ag policy, and he called it Moscow on the Potomac, referring to the place of the Department of Agriculture. But it was we were just as famous for five-year plans and supply management as were the Soviets at their peak. So the dairy program is like that. The dairy program has basically strict limitations of what can be sold without very high tariffs. This is a program called tariff rate quotas, and it is a quantitative basis. So there's a certain amount of dairy products that can be traded or shipped, in this case, exported from the U.S. to Canada, duty-free. And then above that quantitative limit, which is the quota part, there's a high, very high tariff that kicks in. So the initials, the three-letter initials are TRQ, but a tariff rate quota is where you have a quantitative restriction on the amount of goods that can move freely in a specific category. And what it appears is that there were some commitments made by Canada to liberalize their dairy TRQs that the U.S. negotiators understood it one way, and it appears the Canadians thought about it a different way. It really has to do with who gets a shot at the quota, who gets a shot at the part of the production that goes duty free. And that dispute excluded, Canada's interpretation excluded retailers and other closely held operations. And so the U.S. thinks they're in a breach of what they thought they agreed to. Canada thinks they are complying with what they thought they agreed to. And we're basically stuck at he said, she said. But it's unfortunate for U.S. dairy farmers who thought they were going to get something out of this. It's a difficult program to justify because it really is a cartel operated for the existing producers. It does not take any account of a growing market. It doesn't take into account other efficiencies or opportunities. So it's tough. It's about as non-market as you get. But that's where we stand. And once you lose a panel in USMCA, there is no appeal. So things are what they are.
So once you smacks you down, you're done.
That's the way the ball bounces. Yes.
There's a little lesson here for trade negotiators, I think, which is, read the fine print and spend some time thinking about the fine print. Mm-hmm. As near as I can tell, the disagreement, I mean, Scott's right. It's been the same words are being interpreted in two different ways. If you listen to the U.S. side, they seem to be saying that the Canadian implementation of the agreement does not reflect the intent of the negotiators. Now, that may be a way of saying that doesn't reflect the intent of the American negotiators, but it's sort of an intent versus the actual text agreement. And I think the Canadians are saying, if you look at the letter of the wording, we win. And the Americans seem to be saying, it's not the letter of the wording alone. It's what we meant by the letter of the wording when we did it, and you should lose. And the panel sided with the letter of the wording. And I think the lesson for negotiators there is pay a lot of attention to the fine print and make sure that it says exactly what it is that you want it to say so you can avoid this kind of problem in the future.
This happens on occasion. It's very difficult to deal with the elected officials who thought it was one way when it turns out to be another way. Bill, I'm sure you remember the famous kerfuffle over the FISC ETI back in the aughts.
Oh, yes.
Where WTO decision caused the United States to actually change its tax law. So, we complied, but it was one of those things. It was very hard to explain to a member of Congress that the Europeans got their footnote in and we didn't get ours. And that's why they had to do this. Just discussions you didn't want to have.
That was a case where the Europeans got their footnote in 1947.
Yeah.
Yeah. And here we were in
2004 or something like that.
Yeah. Trying to get our footnote in and, you're right. The Europeans out negotiated us 60 years ago, more than 60
okay.
years ago.
Okay, stuff happens.
Okay, so guys, so what are next steps? How's the United States going to react to actually losing here?
Well, there's much unhappiness if you read the papers, but I don't know what can be done about the unhappiness. whether you just try again.
Too bad. Pay me.
Yeah, right.
Well, that's what the Canadians are going to say. We're slow rolling. The other one we lost. We lost one to Mexico on interpretive issue, and we lost it. I think, you know, we deserve to lose it, in my opinion. But nothing has happened since we lost it, which was now coming into the second year. So we're slow rolling that one. I don't know if we're going to slow roll this one or not. The decision was pretty clear. So we'll see. This is one. This is a little bit different. In the Mexican case, losing meant that we were supposed to change our rules. And this had to do with auto rules of origin and what was known as the roll-up issue, which we've discussed before, and I won't bore everybody by trying to discuss it again. But it's incumbent on the United States to comply with the ruling by changing our regulations. In this case, it's different because they're not our regulations that were the issue. It was the Canadians' regulations. And since they won, they don't have to do anything.
Yes.
And there's not much we can do about it. So if there's a slightly slow rolling to be done, it'll be on any retaliation that we would undertake, which would probably be illegal under USMACA and therefore subject to yet another complaint.
You know, if there's a disappointment in all this, it's that you have an industry that could be very competitive and could have a massive global market if it oriented itself to think that way. I remember being stunned after going to Costa Rica on a visit to a company's operation there after the U.S. Central America Free Trade Agreement had been implemented. And every restaurant that I went to during this week visit, on the table was New Zealand butter. I looked at a map and I realized how far New Zealand was from Costa Rica. And yet, New Zealand's butter dairy industry was competitively exporting a product that was on the table for everyone to see, despite the fact the United States had a free trade agreement with Costa Rica. You know, what's that? And the more I dug into the issue, the more it's the orientation of the industry. It's what they see as a business opportunity. New Zealand, particularly Fonterra, their large dairy cooperative, looks at the world as an economic unit. It looks at the whole place as that whole planet is our oyster if we want it. And they're very outward looking, and they're producing for a much larger market and succeeding magnificently. So good for them. I'm not sure there's an implication other than disappointment for U.S. or Canadian dairy. The U.S. is doing a better job probably than it was 20 years ago, but there's a world out there, guys.
Well, you know you're a trade guy when you're in Costa Rica and you're examining where the butter comes from.
Yes, it's a sickness for which there is no cure. So pay me.
More important, Scott, where was the ketchup coming from?
It was from the U.S. They had the little Heinz envelopes.
There you go.
Excellent.
There you go.
There's a company that's outward looking.
Yes.
All right. Speaking of beloved U.S. companies, the European Union is taking aim at the U.S. whiskey industry. Gentlemen, as you know, when this emerged this week, this sent me into crisis mode. I went on something of a rant to Bill. I'm a bit mortified, and I didn't even know that they drank American whiskey in Europe. Every time I'm in Europe, everyone's drinking scotch.
Well, I was the one that had to explain it to Andrew that he shouldn't be too worried about American supply, because this is the stuff that we're shipping to them, not the stuff that they're shipping to us, which we've been known to put tariffs on from time to time, too. But
Lord knows we've got enough customers here in America to satisfy.
Yes, well, that's one of the indicated actions. We'll have to drink more.
Yeah.
American whiskey.
I'm thinking about Kentucky. I'm thinking about some of these regional bourbon makers that are so good in Colorado, in Wyoming, in Texas,
well,
right here in Maryland. Oh, my.
You just mentioned the key insight.
Exactly.
Is that when there are products chosen for a suspension of concessions, as it's called, there's a political element to it. And while I wish Leader McConnell a long and productive career, the fact that the Senate Minority Leader is from the state of Kentucky is a factor in what gets chosen for this so-called retaliation.
So they're picking on Mitch McConnell.
Well, they're hoping to influence him to take action. Think of it as a pressure campaign.
This never works, but it's tried frequently. The EU actually has a list of items, and every time there's a retaliation opportunity, they trot out the list and then say they're going to pick from the list. And they tend to calibrate the ones they actually pick, should the moment come where they want to retaliate, to exactly what Scott said, to political leaders in the Congress that would be most affected by what they're doing. So when the Paul Ryan was the Speaker of the House, watch out for cheese, okay? Mm-hmm. When Mitch McConnell, who still is the Republican leader in the Senate, it's going to be bourbon. And this is predictable. The current speaker is from Louisiana. I don't, Andrew, what do they make in Shreveport?
Well, there's a lot of sugar made in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm. Well,
there's,
we don't really export much sugar. We don't even.
A lot of gumbo made in Louisiana.
there you go.
But it's, you know, it does happen. At one time, there was an issue with Mexico, and their retaliation list included pet food because they had identified that time a Procter & Gamble owned pet food plant in Ohio, and they were hoping to put some pressure on Senator Sherrod Brown for the whatever. I don't even remember the details of the issue. What they neglected to figure into the equation was we also had a pet food plant in Mexico, and so we just increased the production there. The only losers for the retaliation that was put in place by the government of Mexico were the truck drivers who were trucking the product from the Ohio plant to northern Mexico, basically. So Bill points out it doesn't work very often, if ever, but it's appears people must get some entertainment value out of it, or they wouldn't spend so much time doing it.
Well, so in all seriousness, though, how does the Biden administration safeguard small businesses? Like, some of the whiskey distillers are huge, but a lot of them are very boutique and small. And, you know, are there negative effects that these small businesses are suffering, or is this, again, just sort of posturing?
Well, let's boost domestic consumption. That would be the first and probably most straightforward step.
More for us, not for you.
And the international rules, yes. More for us.
Hey, if I can get more Blantons more easily, I'll be totally a happy guy.
Yep, with you 100%.
I think they're going to deal with it by kicking the can again. The issue involved, this is relates to the steel and aluminum tariffs, mm-hmm. where the Europeans retaliated initially on whiskey, among other things. And the tariffs were suspended 2+ years ago in order to negotiate an agreement to permanently remove them. And as of yesterday or this week, I think the Europeans are now professing to be very pessimistic about being able to conclude that agreement. You'll recall we talked about this when it was Europe Week in October, when they were here and the summit with von der Leyen was here along with Michel, the president of the Council of Presidents, and they were not able to reach an agreement at that point, even when you had top level attention on it. And nothing has gotten better since. But I think nobody wants to reimpose the tariffs in either direction, and the EU is now tended more or less switched to can we make some tweaks in what the US did instead, because why the US suspended the tariffs, they put in a tariff rate quota system actually for steel and aluminum, which seems to be working, but the Europeans would like it to work a little differently than the way it is working, and so they're lobbying now for some tweaks in the system, which implicitly is suggesting they've kind of given up on trying to have a deal to solve the problem in its entirety. I think the odds are that both sides will kick the can for another at least a year to get us past both elections. We know we have one because we talk about it all the time. People don't remember that the Europeans have one also in May and June. They're going to be electing a new European Parliament, and then there will be a new president of the Commission and a new slate of commissioners that will take office next December or next November. And so I think they'll kick the can to get past that, and then it will be the next administration in both countries that will have to try to deal with it. So don't panic, Andrew. I think you've got another year at least of the status quo.
Good to know. Guys, I won't panic, and thank you so much for calming me down. Thank you for this wonderful discussion, and we will see you next time.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thank you.
To our listeners, if you have a question for the Trade Guys, write us at tradeguys@csis.org. That's tradeguys@csis.org. We'll read some of your emails and have the Trade Guys react to it. You've been listening to The Trade Guys, a CSIS podcast.